listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we bring you an update of news and events from the Latin America Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. We begin with the attempted assassination on Saturday of Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro by exploding drone attack. Aside from the shock of seeing the attempted assassination of President Maduro over the weekend, there's just so many things going on in and around Latin America, Caribbean over the past week, of moment, including, for example, what's going to happen with the Ecuadorian embassy in London and Julian Assange and the presidencies of a number of other countries, regardless of whether they succeed in shooting Maduro. I mean, I just had the feeling that the CIA must have bought some drones at the same store they bought those exploding cigars from that they tried to take out Fidel with 100 different times. Because what a horrible failure for them, huh?
Well, yeah, and it's you can kind of have this kind of negative humor, if you like, about it. But it's it's very, very serious
for sure.
A very serious event. In a context in which, there's always so much going on, isn't there? And it's confusing, sure. And you try and make sense of it, and try and put our analysis of that has some explanatory power,
right?
About why, what is all this stuff?
Trying to make sense out of it in one way or another.
So, from my point of view, and I think that the recent coup attempt in Nicaragua that has definitely failed, and everything's back to normal, but there's a lot to say about that. And there's even more to say about the assassination attempt against President Nicolas Maduro. But and I think we have to put all this stuff that's going on in the context of the United States elite's desperate efforts, along with their local allies and proxies in Latin America and the Caribbean, to do something to try and secure the Americas, as it were, Latin America, the Caribbean, North America, against their kind of chronic, it is a chronic decline in power and influence at a global level, right? So all these things that are happening have to be seen in that light. And my interpretation is that the US elites, they thought that they'd easily overthrow President Maduro over the last 3-4 years by diplomatic and economic pressure, commercial pressure, financial pressure, and they failed. And as Maduro said himself in his address to the nation immediately after the attempt, the murder attempt, they are right now completely revamping, overhauling their exchange rate mechanisms, a whole bunch of stuff to do with the economy, really, really fundamental stuff to do with the economy that they hope will take Venezuela out of its dependence on oil income, and create an economy that is capable, although it, obviously oil is going to continue to be its most important component in the economy for some time yet. They want to create the conditions whereby, as oil becomes less important in their economy, and their economy is ready for that and able to cope with the shock, if you like, of transiting from being dependent on oil to being a much more diversified economy. And Maduro said that the reason they had that assassination attempt is because the Venezuelan elites are terrified, and their U.S. Owners are terrified at the fact that the Venezuelan government is going to win the economic war. They won the political war. They're holding their own on the diplomatic front. And now they're on the verge of breaking the stranglehold that the United States has had on Venezuela's economy as a result of economic sanctions and so forth.
I mean, we've been talking about, for years now, since the U.S. really started cranking down on Venezuela's economy, and when you had the, whether coincidental or engineered dumping of commodities prices that really put pressure on Venezuela and some others, that at some point the state was going to find it necessary to actually wage the class war at like a more aggressive level, that the accommodation with the right and with the local bourgeoisie that you've seen kind of as a project across the region, where like in Nicaragua, for example, where successfully certain elements of the domestic bourgeoisie are on board with the government, and they help to actually construct the economy, where you had instead overt war being conducted by the local bourgeoisie on the economy, that you force the government to move forward with a program of socialism. We saw that with the distribution networks, for example, in Venezuela, where the private distribution networks were warehousing goods so that people couldn't buy toilet paper and whatever else, not because of any failure of the system, but because there was a distributor strike, in essence, where they were hoarding this stuff. And so what they ended up doing was saying, okay, well, the state's going to distribute these things. And every step that the U.S. takes at this point kind of has that dialectical response almost built into it. And if the last resort that they have is economic warfare, and if what that does is compel the state or a socialist government to conduct the economic warfare, and if they win, what does that say for the example to the rest of the world?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's by no means clear, of course, that the Venezuelan government's measures are going to be successful.
Right. But it's existential at the level of threat. In case that happens, even if it's one in a million, it's like, yikes.
Yeah, exactly. And it's much more than one in a million, because they've really thought hard about the measures. And although there's some uncertainty about how effective they're going to be, particularly in the short term, there's no doubt at all that as a kind of well thought out, coherent response to the very deep structural problems in Venezuela's economy, inherited from a century of dependence on oil income, the measures proposed by the government make a really radical departure, as you say, in favor of a more democratic economy.
Right.
Yep. And it's interesting, and I think one of the things that really has struck me about the crisis here in Nicaragua, and it was also very marked in Venezuela's ongoing crisis, is the bad faith of people. You expect downright lies and dishonesty from the right wing and from the NATO country media like the New York Times and the Guardian and the BBC and National Public Radio and all of them. You just expect them to kind of be totally dishonest and unreliable. But from people who project themselves as being progressive or radical or, you know, in some way, you expect something better, right? You expect at least an attempt to appreciate the complex contradictions involved in looking at how countries locked into a global imperialist capitalist system are struggling against what that means in terms of their domestic economies to try and build some kind of socialist alternative. And so you get, and I'm particularly fed up at the moment with a guy called Eric Toussaint, who's a very well-known European research on debt and indebtedness and so forth. And he has written about Nicaragua's crisis, criticizing the government here for being neoliberal, you know, the depths of ignorance, really. And it's difficult how otherwise to characterize that. So you get really knowledgeable people, really economically sophisticated people, talking absolute nonsense about, in this case, Nicaragua, but also Venezuela, and obviously, and Cuba's always been kind of the victim of that kind of stuff. But and the reason I think it's important in this context is that what you have is, you know, why is the United States attacking Venezuela? It's not attacking them because they're neoliberal, for goodness sake.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, if they were neoliberal, even as people like Toussaint like to claim, you know, Toussaint, by the way, just for people who are not familiar with him, this is a guy who grew up in a petty bourgeois household. Both parents were teachers. I think Belgian, if that memory serves. Prominent Trotskyist. He's been a part of the central committees of the Fourth International for years. So, you know, we're talking about someone who essentially looks at any socialist construction or movement towards that anywhere in the world as being deficient, wrong, I forget what the word they used to use, malformed or whatever, towards the Soviet Union, and a failure that should be left alone. Let capitalism take care of it. Someday there'll be a real revolution with honest revolutionaries. He's on that page. So
that takes us into another area, and it's especially true of Venezuela and Nicaragua. And that takes us into an area we were talking about just before we began this conversation on air, which is the issue of how do you build and consolidate an international movement or network capable of confronting the attacks of United States imperialism and its allies against vulnerable countries like in Nicaragua, Haiti, you know, Venezuela, Ivory Coast, Mali, pick a country, you know, and how do you build that? And one of the ways that you do it is by, we've had a good experience in relation to Nicaragua, trying to, different people with really quite different points of view, just agreeing to disagree and focusing on defending Nicaragua's revolution and the Sandinista government against this, what was a very serious, critical attack against the process that Nicaragua had set in train in 2007 with the with President Ortega taking office in January 2007. This goes back to something that you were saying, Don, just now. When in Nicaragua, what was the political significance of their alliance with the business right of the business classes? What it actually allowed them to do, apart from build up the economy and GDP and all that, all those conventional measures, it did something much more important, which was to fundamentally democratize the economy so that you have a situation where Nicaragua is one of the few countries in the world, and certainly in Latin America, that produces between 80 and 90% of its own of the food that it consumes. No, that's absolutely fundamental in terms of food sovereignty and independence.
Yep.
And you have an economy now where around 70% of the economically active population produce, or depending on how you measure GDP, but in terms of income, I think they produce around 52-53% of GDP. And then the other big sectors are, of course, government spending, foreign investment, and the private business sector. But when you look at that, the private business sector only generates about 15% of the country's employment. Between 15 and 20, and so you have 70% generated by this grassroots popular economy, around 15% generated by the private business sector, and the rest is in the public sector.
Yep.
Right. So and as a result of foreign investment in the maquilas here, which is another issue that maybe we can talk about another time. Right. But what that fundamentally means is that in these 10 years, or 10, 11 years since 2007, what the government's done is taken the opportunity to have a truce with the business classes, to build up the popular economy. And it was the popular economy that sustained Nicaragua through the 3 months of crisis.
Right.
Because the business sector, in many ways, was trying to, it was part of the boycott.
Right. Certainly chunks of it were, for sure.
Yeah. So, absolutely, and then there were chunks that weren't, because they were being badly affected by the roadblocks and the blockade. And as Daniel Ortega said in a recent interview he gave to RT, I think it's published today, the interview was last week, but in the interview he says that the country was effectively blockaded for about 2 months.
Right. I mean, so, the kinds of things you're talking about, just a real quick insertion. Let's say that you have the cooperative potato growers, okay, growing potatoes cooperatively, and there's a private firm that trucks them from farm to market. If you're going to strike, cause, the right wing at the stores, for example, is going to strike against the distribution of the potatoes, well, there's this part of the private sector that's adversely affected also, the ones that truck them in. And their interests end up being tied to the interests of the cooperative economy as opposed to the interests of the totally private, corporate economy.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing to remember, I know when ignorant individuals like Eric Toussaint talk about neoliberal Nicaragua, and they really are displaying their complete ignorance of the economy. For example, the transport sector is managed almost entirely by cooperatives.
Mm. Okay.
This is what people are so, they sound ridiculous when they talk about Nicaragua because they're so ignorant about it. Can include people like Noam Chomsky in that as well. And they just don't know what has been happening in Nicaragua for the last 10 years.
Right.
They just don't know.
Well, they're not going to get it from the New York Times, okay, or from the Washington Post. Really looking at U.S. media, since I heard that this had happened, I think it was Friday night or Saturday night, whenever, right after it, an hour after it happened, and there was go ahead, because I want to spend a couple minutes with this, and I'll let you finish your point first.
Yeah, sure. I know, Don. I know all I was going to say was that, in that That is why the United States, that's one of the reasons why the United States is attacking Nicaragua, because it's building a successful grassroots popular economy that is capable of resisting a certain level of economic aggression, like, as we saw over the last 3 months. And then, but then one of the interesting things that has come out of this is that it's become very clear that the United States political classes and the political establishment and Wall Street and the financial establishment targeted the agreement that the Nicaraguan private business sector had with the government via measures like, first they started with the NICA Act attacking government access to funding, which is still to be passed into law, as I understand it. But they also did implement something, what's it called, the Magnitsky Act.
Right.
Which allows the U.S. government to target particular individuals. And the Nicaraguan business classes were terrified by the threat of becoming victims of the Magnitsky Act.
Right.
And that was one, among many things, that it was one of the important things, that they sent a message, the United States establishment sent a message to the Nicaraguan business classes saying very clearly, we are now threatening you, right, if you continue to work with the government.
Yeah.
And what has been the result of that? The result of that here in Nicaragua has been that the private sector organization, it's called COSEP here, has ordered all its members to resign any appointments that they have in government institutions, like the central bank, for example, or the boards of different institutions. And so that what that means is that it'll be very interesting to see how the government copes with that.
Those things start rolling, by the way. Go back to Libya, and I remember there being these phased, staged resignations of both government officials, like, for example, the UN ambassador.
Right.
And not even a resignation. Here's an interesting approach to resigning or withdrawing support for the government. I am the ambassador of Libya to the United Nations. Some Qatari guys and Al-Qaeda guys invade in the east, and the U.S. starts bombing my country. So I resign, but I continue at the U.N. as the representative of Libya. Even though there's been no change of government, my occupation of that position essentially is used as a lever for the UN to say, well, we're going to recognize those 12 guys over there with three rifles as the government, as opposed to the government at the United Nations. I mean, they work every little, and when I was seeing this and people were talking about, these things are being staged, these resignations, they're part and parcel of a regime change operation. You can see it if you step back, in motion. It's like there's no one that has control of events like that. But you see it in Nicaragua when they're actually making the call for that thing. It's like, look, this is a class war. We're about to go to battle, folks. You're standing on the wrong side of the line.
Right.
You know?
Oh, yeah. And you can see it in the OAS as well, can't you? And in Libya, it was the UN's Human Rights Commission that was hijacked by Libyan human rights organizations that spread downright lies, just like the Nicaraguan human rights organizations are doing, and their Venezuelan equivalents do in Venezuela.
And they turned on a dime, like with Nicaragua, in Venezuela. I mean, in Libya also. In December of 2010, that they were about to issue. In fact, they had issued this report saying that Libya's, human rights, amazing. Look at what they've done with the country in the last 40 years. Oh my goodness, what a model! Like six weeks later, it's like, and by the way, what a bunch of butchers.
Well, right, yeah. And you have the same thing in Nicaragua.
Yeah.
Nicaragua's policing was recognized as a model for the region.
The economic, the uplifting of everybody, all of it. The whole Nicaragua was held out like, look at this model. They're way ahead of the millennium goals. They're, you know, every measure, these guys are kicking butt and taking names. And then suddenly, oh, except that they're fascists and neoliberal crazies and all of that.
Yeah, and so in the Organization of American States, they've done exactly the same as they did against Venezuela. Yeah. Illegally holding one meeting after another of the OAS Permanent Council, which I think consists of the OAS members' foreign ministers, that level. And so they passed a resolution, yet another illegal resolution, in this case against Nicaragua, last week, setting up a commission to investigate what's going on in Nicaragua. And so, but Nicaragua has taken the position in accordance with the rules of the OAS that's completely illegal, and they're not going to receive that commission in Nicaragua. So,
right.
And that, you see, in many ways that doesn't matter. All that, so much right. of this is they need to get formal decisions taken that they can then use as ammunition to
right.
say
that's right. Yeah, it's a headline in the New York Times. Then OAS. Declares Nicaragua outlaw state. U.S. Right. offers military assistance to group of Central American countries seeking to right the situation. You know, whatever. Well,
it was very interesting, though, Don, that Guatemala, I think Guatemala voted against. If they didn't vote against, they certainly abstained.
That's
very interesting, because they understand very well that what can happen today to somebody they don't feel particularly close to, tomorrow can happen to them.
Even if he is a comedian.
Even if he is a comedian. Jimmy Morales, yeah.
Okay, so we've got about 6 minutes left, not even, 5 minutes left, and like we haven't covered yet Brazil and Lula and Haiti, the protests there, Bolivia with Evo Morales, Ecuador with Moreno purging his opponents and acting, well, all this stuff, Argentina, Peru, Cuba's new constitution, by the way, et cetera. We're going to have to maybe later this week do another segment and update that stuff. But what I would like to do is just delve into what actually happened this Saturday in Venezuela and the fallout from it, because it's not being reported well or accurately here at all.
All right. Well, and the facts are very simple. And Nicolas Maduro, late on Saturday afternoon, was at something like the 51st anniversary of the armed forces in Venezuela. And he was just coming to the end of his address to the assembled units of the armed forces, and then these drones, remote-controlled aerial drones, appeared, and I think two of them exploded. And the reports that I read said that the Venezuelan security forces shot down at least one more, maybe more. It turns out they were loaded with C4 explosives, sufficient to cause damage and injury within a radius of 50 meters. And they were exploded immediately in front of where President Maduro was speaking, injured, and I think it was seven people present there, mainly people in the armed forces who were attending the event. They didn't hit Maduro, who was remarkably serene through it all.
Yeah, that's amazing. And actually, there was a public relations effort to show the contrary. It was kind of funny watching it here unfolding in the U.S. media. The Washington Post was following a line that was also being peddled by the opposition in Latin America, which was there was no attack on Maduro. There was a gas tank that exploded in an apartment building across the street. And so the conclusion is this thing blew up. It scared everybody, including half the troops that are loyal to Maduro. They all ran off because they show video of people running from where the explosions were taking place, because they were ordered to. They leave that out. And that was the whole thing. And Maduro was using this as an excuse for another crackdown. That's the Washington Post. Venezuela embraces crackdown.
Absolutely. And of course it's going to get manipulated like that.
Then they had to change it because there was just too much documentation of the factual activity, where now the Washington Post, about Sunday morning, 11 o'clock or so, changed their tune and acknowledged that it was a drone attack.
Yeah, and this is in the context in which Duque, the new Colombian president, takes office on Wednesday, I think it is. And Duque, and in the Colombian context, Uribe originally resigned from the Senate because to avoid a Supreme Court investigation, then suddenly changed his mind. It all seems Duque is very much Alvaro Uribe's creature,
right.
And he may change. He may change, but at the moment, that's what he is.
Yep.
The reason he's becoming the president is because he had the support of Uribe's corrupt narco-terror network, and with all the advantages that brings,
right.
And that's how he's becoming the president on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. But he is at Maduro in his address. Said very clearly that the people that were behind the attack, he identified very clearly Juan Manuel Santos, right. and Duque is, and being Uribe's boy,
right.
Is very, very much to the right, even of Juan Manuel Santos.
I know that's an interesting thing there because the outgoing president Santos and Uribe. Very, very hostile towards each other, and Uribe, his successor, wins this particular round. There's a parallel because I'm wondering here: Trump, the one who was talking about no more regime change, flying and criticizing Obama over drones, flying in a half dozen drones to a public event to blow up the president of another country, seems inconsistent, and one wonders, I don't know this, and I'm sure as hell not trying to make excuses for anybody, but did the orders for this come down from the White House, or is this some of the deep state?
Sudden command.
Yes, right. Is this like the deep state in alliance with,
with Rubio and Ross Lehtinen and all those people?
Who knows, yeah.
Yeah, and there's definitely a parallel state down there, and the Southern Command has its fiefdom that works hand in glove with the extreme right wing figures like Rubio.
Yeah, so we're going to have to come back at this point because we're out of time. Just very quickly, like 20, 30 seconds, it's quieter around you now in Nicaragua.
Oh yeah, and we're all back to normal, but of course they're in the media, they can't admit that.
Right, of course.
So if anybody wants a holiday, please come to Nicaragua. We need you.
I might come down and visit. You may clear off some space on a couch there, because you may find somebody sleeping on it next time you turn around.
You're very welcome, John.
Great. Okay. Tony, thank you very much. Pleasure as always.
Okay.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. The United States and the Philippines have a curious history together. Once a colony, then a staunch military ally, Manila is now trying to take steps to redefine and rebalance its relationship with Washington and, by extension, some of its friends and foes. How is it going so far? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Alan Peter Cayetano, Secretary of Foreign Affairs of the Philippines. Secretary, it's a great pleasure, great honor welcoming you in the studio. Thank you very much for coming over.
The honor is mine. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, your visit to Moscow comes at a time when you cannot even describe the relationship between Russia and the United States intelligently. I mean, it's a big mess, and I don't think we can even put some label on it. I wonder if you believe this trip of yours will be noticed in Washington.
Well, friends in need are friends indeed. Russia, the Russian Federation, President Putin, came to the aid of the Philippines while we were fighting terrorism in Marawi, and we owe it to Russia to also come and show our friendship, whether there are world issues or not being discussed. Mm-hmm. Our bilateral relationship is strong, and we want it to be stronger.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's discuss your relationship with the United States first, because obviously it has a much longer history mm-hmm. than your relationship with Russia. I heard you compare mm-hmm. your relationship with Washington to that of a family with a kid who came of age and wants to chart his or her own path, which means meeting with people that the parents do not necessarily approve of. And you yourself come from a very well-placed family. I'm sure you honor your parents' requests above everybody else's. Is that how the Philippines relate to the United States these days?
Well, my father is a Filipino from the smallest town in Metro Manila, and my mother is an American. And my mother and my father loves my mother very much, but always said that the Americans cannot dictate to the Filipinos what to do, and it's up to the Filipinos to chart their own destiny. President Duterte comes from this generation of appreciating the history, noting that there were low points in the history, times that we were taken advantage of, but noting also that the strong military ties and the aid and the help and the people-to-people relationship, there's 3.5 million Filipino-Americans or Filipinos in the U.S. Having said that, you know, it's like you love your parents, but they can't dictate your life to you.
Absolutely. But Secretary, I think in every functioning family, the parents remain the authority figures even after the children leave the house. This is what I'm trying to get from you. How much of an authority you vest in the preferences in the opinions of the United States at this point of time?
Well, that's precisely what we want to change, you know. We will not swallow hook, line, and sinker that we have common or the same interest. When our interests diverge, we will pursue what is in our best interest. When there are common interests, we shall pursue it. But gone are the days when anything that the West or Americans and allies say is good for us. You know, we're not in the Cold War. I came from...
Well, some people say we are in an even worse period than the Cold War these
days. I told your students today, students for international relations, from the Cold War mentality, we should have the Coldplay mentality. You know, and it's all about fixing ourselves, about, you know, seeing the light and being honest with each other. We live in a multipolar world, and the U.S. And the other great powers have to find its place in a new world order.
Now, this new policy of independence is associated first and foremost with President Rodrigo Duterte, who, judging from polls, remains quite popular among your countrymen. But as you yourself never tire of saying, the Philippines is a democracy and therefore can elect somebody with a totally different vision. Help us understand here how much of the current posture is tied directly to the president, his personality, and how much of it is institutionally driven that will outlast him?
Well, in the sense that President Duterte gave no illusions, and during the campaign said, this is how I'll treat China, this is how I'll treat the U.S. I don't want anyone dictating upon the Filipino people. I'm accountable only to the Filipino people. So in that sense, it's very institutional. In the sense that it's very personal, it's really the president under our constitution that dictates a foreign policy. But our constitution says independent foreign policy, meaning a foreign policy for Filipinos. But in the past, we've always said whatever the U.S. or the West says, that's right for us.
What is your sense of your own people's desires? Do you think that kind of orientation is going to stand for longer than years that President Duterte has in office?
My godfather was always telling me, in the time that we had Walkmans, if you ask anyone, do you want an iPod? No one will say, I want an iPod, because you didn't know what it was. You didn't know what iTunes was. So, you know, we're now discovering what a real independent foreign policy is, what it is to have a mature friendship with the U.S., but telling them that we want a mature relationship with Russia. We have a dispute with China, but still we want a relationship with China and the rest of the world. So it's too early to tell, but I can say there's a lot of excitement. Mm-hmm. There'll be a lot of benefits for the Chinese people, the Filipino people, the Russian people. We have a lot of Chinese Filipinos. But when the former president went against China, they were just quiet. So now there's some noise, there's some people who are quiet in the U.S., but they know that the people-to-people relationship, you know, is tied but still different from the international relationship of state to state.
Now, the reason I'm asking is because the Philippines is definitely not alone in adopting this more versatile foreign policy. What you say is very similar to how, for example, the Pakistanis describe their relationship with the United States and other actors. So it does look like a broader trend. The question is, and it is often asked by our American colleagues, is whether it is likely to make Asia more or less stable.
If I may answer your question by a direct example. So you talk to the Americans and they're saying they're increasing their presence in the South China Sea and in ASEAN because the Chinese are also getting more aggressive and building some defensive postures and putting military assets on some features in the South China Sea. And according to the Americans, the sea lanes there are too important for world commerce. You talk to the Chinese, they'll tell you that 70% of their economy passes through that channel and commerce is too important to that. So both are saying the same thing, but from an opposite point of view. So what do we do as Filipinos? Do we be pro-Chinese or do we be pro-America? Or do we tell both of them we're pro-Filipino and you guys have to talk and work out these regional rivalries so that the us in ASEAN and the Philippines won't be caught in between? So I think it's not just a trend. It's the right thing to do.
It's really difficult not to be caught in between, especially as tensions grow.
Yes, but it's not the Cold War anymore. There's no left and right and wrong, or evil and good. You know, it's a multipolar world. You have bilateral relationships. You have multilateral relationships. You have transnational crimes. You have terrorism. So, you know, we have to get, we have to find a way not only to live with each other, but find a way, a world order where all of us have an opportunity for greatness.
Can I ask you, though, we discussed a little bit the complexity of your relationship with the United States, how you try to rebalance it while retaining the positives. I'm sure your relationship with China, I mean, it follows a different trajectory, but you would agree perhaps that the choreography of that is just as complex and challenging. On a personal level, on a professional level, who do you find more challenging, the Americans or the Chinese, when you negotiate with them?
Oh, well, you know, as I said in a think tank in the U.S., the Americans are our parents, but we're saying we're off to college and allow us to pick our own friends. The Chinese are our roommates. You know, they're close neighbors. So regardless what we do with each other and how we treat each other, it's going to affect our economy, our people, our security. You know, so the complexity comes in not in the bilateral relationship, but in the overall regional and world rivalries and in the world order. So it's equally challenging. But we are speaking this frankly to our American counterparts and to the members of the U.S. Congress who care about the Philippines. And we think to a frank discussion, you know, we'll get somewhere.
Now, you just mentioned your talk at the Council on Foreign Relations last year. And in that talk, you also suggested that the Russians are a bit cautious about pursuing a relationship with the Philippines because of this deeply ingrained Cold War perception of your country as a very, very close American associate. Not even an ally, I would say.
Yes.
I think more like an associate or an aide. How far have Moscow and Manila gotten ahead in practical terms?
My perception is that both in Moscow and Manila, there were policymakers who say, you know, take it a step at a time, be cautious. This just might be a connection between President Putin and President Duterte, or very good talks between Prime Minister Medvedev and President Duterte, you know. But from that time on, you know, we've had, for example, we were buying arms from the U.S. And because certain members of Congress were making noise about alleged human rights violation, you know, when we needed the arms most, it wasn't there. But here comes China and here comes Russia. Despite policymakers in Beijing and Moscow saying, let's be careful, let's see what's happening, you know, took a leap of faith and came to Manila's aid. Don't get me wrong, the U.S. also helped us in Marawi, and the Australians, the Japanese, you know, and we appreciate this. But what we're saying is that we want that mature, real friendship. We may be a smaller country.
Well, that that friendship also has a material benefit to all the sides involved. So it's not only friendship, but also
and
business.
We're not that far away. I mean, Russia is
speaking about Asia. I have a perfect question for you on that subject, because I think you have some very funny, amazing metaphors. I heard you say that with 10 million Filipinos living abroad, you guys are expert in long-distance relationships. I think we here in Russia are a bit worse at that. We tend to develop stronger ties with those who are either close to us or at least those we can reach to territorially through land. What could possibly breach this more than 8,000-kilometer distance between Moscow and Manila?
Well, discovery. I think the more we discover Russia and the more Russia discovers the Filipinos, we'll find out that we have a lot of things in common. We both have a strong sense of identity and are finding our place not only in society, in the world, but both of us just, you know, wants to get along with the rest of the world, have enough food at the table.
But
you know,
we are also often misunderstood in our intentions, right? This is one of the things that may...
Because of, again, the Cold War mentality. I mean, again, it's always packaged in some Western media that this is correct, this is wrong. You know, so we have to judge countries' actions and leaders' directives case per case. You know, you cannot say everything U.S. does is correct, or you cannot also say everything the U.S. does is wrong.
Absolutely.
So we need more objective. But the reality is, you know, media tries to give the facts, but also leans towards their worldview. So this is where social media and direct communication comes in. Unfortunately, it's sometimes called fake news. It sometimes is, but it's sometimes actually a different worldview packaged as fake news by powerful people.
Now, I know that Russia in particular is interested in marketing its nuclear power and transfer the expertise to the to the Philippines. I wonder, is that something that may be of interest to you, particularly the nuclear energy issue? From what I understand, it's quite a contentious subject in your country.
We are interested in everything that is Russian, and we hope that we can interest Russia with everything that's Filipino, from our warm hospitality to our beautiful islands, countryside, mountains, from your sophisticated military hardware to your transport vehicles, exciting motorcycles, you know.
I asked you specifically about the nuclear power, because from what I know, you actually built one nuclear power plant before, but it never went into operation because
we built
in part
one
of the
that
protest
was
in
infested with corruption, with a, of course, U.S. Company under the guidance of international financial institutions in the U.S., which corruption has been exposed in the last few decades. So the contention is not the use of nuclear power itself or the aid or help of Russia or Russian technology. The issue more of is the location of where the Bataan nuclear power plant is. The controversy is more if we should build there because there are strong feelings given the history. But in so far as cooperation in this matter, we've signed agreements. Our scientists are very excited. Our Department of Science and Technology, our Department of Energy is excited to work with your agencies in atomic and nuclear fields.
Okay. Well, Secretary, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Alan Peter Cayetano, Secretary of Foreign Affairs of the Philippines. Secretary, we mentioned the situation in Marawi before, and I think it would be fair to say that both the attack on that city and the long destructive siege that followed deepened fears among Asian countries as well as across the world that ISIS may seek to expand in other locations after suffering defeats in Syria and Iraq. Just the other day, we heard of a devastating attack in Indonesia perpetrated by a whole family, including four children who returned from Syria. Do you in the Philippines understand how to deal with that issue, how good you are
well,
at that.
First of all, our hearts go out and we express our condolences to all the victims of terrorism worldwide. Even here in Russia, you are no stranger to extremism and acts of terrorism. It was a painful experience, you know, fighting your own countrymen and fighting extremists. You know, it was the first time that there was fighting in a city, in an urban setting. It's usually outside, and it's usually they say that, you know, there are religious undertones or societal or historical differences. But here, it was just Filipino against Filipino in the name of a perverted ideology.
And so, I heard you say on one occasion that there was a real danger at one point of time of that battle transforming from being a battle between terrorism
the
and the government
is still
into
there.
Civil war.
The danger is there. The president is in the best position because he's seen this. He was going around the camps already saying, watch out, keep a keen eye. You know, it will just take, it's like gasoline spread all over, and it just takes a spark. And he knew at that time that Syria and Iraq would soon stabilize, and the Daesh and ISIS will be defeated. And where will go the couple hundreds or a couple thousands of Southeast Asian jihadist fighters who joined Daesh? Where will they go?
How do you think these people should be dealt with? Because it's not only the fighters, it's also the families, it's also the children. Again, the Indonesian recent Indonesian example shows that the children could also be used as suicide bombers.
Well, you know, it should be dealt with like a no-nonsense father with a firm hand but an open heart. You know, no one wants to scold or put in jail or stand in the corner his son or his daughter, you know. But if you lose your way,
but should you let these people into your back into your house when you know that they present a potential danger?
No, if they are terrorists, you know, then they are a threat to all nations, to all people. Having said that, as our brothers in the Gulf have communicated to us, there's need for rehabilitation. There's need to communicate to their families that they have been rescued and not captured, you know. But there's so much to be done, from intelligence sharing, from taking out the fertile grounds for recruitment of that kind of mentality. So poverty and crime and drugs put together just creates that fertile ground of breeding extremist and this kind of ideology.
Now, you mentioned already that the United States and the Philippines have just held joint military exercises to build on the lessons of the Marawi siege, involving some 8,000 troops from both sides, as well as small contingents from Australia and Japan. Is that a sign that your political relations with the United States, which were strained, as you said, over the criticism about the war on drugs, is it a sign that that relationship is improving under Donald Trump?
Our military-to-military relation, you know, never suffered.
With all due respect, President Duterte said that those exercises would be suspended.
Yes, no, we suspended all of the exercises in the South China Sea, and with regards to certain aspects. So the 8,000 you mentioned today, it was more for disaster prevention. So he has refocused to that, and he's keeping it that way. What I'm saying is that if people to people, the relationship is still strong. Military to military, the relationship is strong. And, you know, Russia and China have never said to us and never interfered with our relationship with the United States. So,
but they don't have such close familial ties.
Yes, but that's what makes the relationship strong. When you respect the bilateral relationship of your friend with the other friend, you know, this isn't grade school or high school wherein if you fight with a friend, you want all your other friends to fight with him or two. You know, we have to have mature relationships, and that includes security and defense arrangements.
Now, speaking about maturity and leadership, President Duterte's personal style, his temperament, his sense of humor, sometimes compared to that of Donald Trump. Do you find that comparison flattering?
You know, they're both authentic speakers. They say or they tweet what they want. But, you know, in the Philippines, he's been compared more with President Putin. Political determination, political will, a vision of what to do in the country. Remember, the problem with leaders is not only who they are and what they do and direction, but also the circumstances at home. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very hard to judge President Donald Trump. He's a good friend to the Philippines, but he is in a political circumstances where there are, you know, challenges in all fronts. So we have challenges with the U.S. Congress, challenges with the NGOs who are using human rights as a political weapon, challenges sometimes with the State Department, but we're trying to build those bridges, you know. But in the meantime, President Duterte doesn't really care who he's compared to, you know. He just wants to do a good job.
I understand that it's very easy for the leaders to publicly shrug off that kind of criticism, but yeah. I think it gets to you. And when your country is being maligned over and over again, it's not pleasant, especially if you're dealing with some real life challenges.
I agree, but President Duterte doesn't care. As far as he's concerned, he likes President Trump. They have a good connection. They talk frankly, but as far as President Duterte is concerned, he very much likes. He's called President Putin one of my idols, you know. So, and he says it's none of your business if I like him or not.
Now, incidentally, President Trump also has his own drug epidemics to tackle. And correct me if I'm wrong. He has not only refrained from criticizing the Philippines over the conduct of the war on drugs. He actually said and praised President Duterte for the quote unquote. Unbelievable job on the drug problem. Does the Philippines assess Trump's efforts to address the American opioid crisis in the same way? Do you even analyze what the Americans are doing?
The president has said that he's very supportive. He has empathy. He understands what the Americans are going through. Unfortunately, you know, the EU, the U.S. and Western media do not understand that there are different challenges when it comes to drugs. Now, President Trump is talking about opioids, but in the past, it was about more of cocaine. And cocaine and methamphetamines have different effects. In cocaine, it's a health issue with the person, but that person doesn't go around raping people, killing people, raping 2 years old, shooting their father. Methamphetamines have that effect, and that's what we were trying to explain.
You can counter that with saying that even when you have a mentally disabled person committing a crime, you do put him through assessment and
that's what we're doing. But these human rights groups wants to legalize prohibited drugs, and it's making it appear even the UN rapporteur has said there's no evidence that these kinds of drugs lead to violence. So even with a mentally disturbed person, you know, you identify the dangers to himself or herself, dangers to her family, and do remedy. So we are just remedying the epidemic of drugs, illegal drugs in the Philippines. We respect President Trump's efforts, but we also recognize, as I said, that human rights and drug issues have become so politicized, you know, that we're not discussing it in a level to solve it, but to criticize each other. It's not helpful.
Secretary, I noticed that this war on drugs is pretty much the only thing that Western reporters ever ask you about. And I don't want to focus much on that, but I do want to ask you one more question on this issue. I came across a poll from last year which suggests that 73% of Filipinos worry about becoming victims of extrajudicial killings, and that's about as high as the general public support for the crusade against crime. So that leads me to conclude that people support the goal, but they are a little bit apprehensive about the method. Yeah. Do you share?
Of course, because it depends on the question in the poll. So do you support? So, for example, if you say, do you support nuclear power, and you get 80%, and then a fallout happens somewhere, and you ask the same question, are you concerned that the fallout will happen? Of course, your answer will be yes. You know, but look at the later polls nowadays, you know. People are seeing that we have safer streets. People are seeing that, yes, there are abuses, but this was because of an abusive police force, not because of President Duterte's directive. And with us now buying modern day equipment, more surveillance, more CCTVs, more body cameras, there are more assurances to the public that, you know, this drug campaign is precisely against those who violate the law and those who are violent. You know, President Duterte has told President Trump, and President Trump has listened carefully, that we don't shoot people in cold blood. But what did the American media report? That President Duterte and Trump did not discuss human rights. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're focused on the form, not on the substance. They did discuss human rights in a manner of a friendly nations respecting each other's sovereignty.
What would you say to those who claim that the Duterte administration has been a bit blinded by this anti-drug campaign and overcommitted police and army resources to counter the drug problem at the expense of other security challenges, which could have led to the situation we discussed previously in Marawi?
Well, we care about the Filipino. We care about the Philippines. And we know that we would have woken up to a day that we were a narco state if we don't do this. So we don't really care that much about the people who has the luxury to provide solutions that didn't work or were given the chance to solve the problem and didn't ignore the problem. So any country with an existential threat is always criticized that they're focused too much on that threat. But precisely why you call it an existential threat, it's a threat to your existence. So if we don't pay that, if the president didn't put that focus, we'll wake up one day that all families in the Philippines have problems with drugs, with violence, and a narco state. We've already seen generals, we've seen politicians, we've seen high officials, we've seen billions, millions, thousands of pesos in drugs. We've saw a cachet of cash and drugs in Marawi. So I think we prove our point that it is a real danger to us. And if other people want to ignore it, if other NGOs want to politicize it, that's their problem. But we'll deal with the real problem.
Well, Secretary, unfortunately, we have to leave it there. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
I
appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you. And I encourage our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages. And I hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.